From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, as the village of Mount Pleasant continues its fight for rights over private properties in the footprint of Foxconn, we look at how the situation stacks up to other cases of eminent domain.
Then why a group of Parkinson's disease patients is gathering in a boxing gym in West Allis.
We'll work on footwork, we'll work on hand-eye coordination, speed of movement, all the things you would see in a regular boxer we're taking on, and it's just happens to be people with Parkinson's that are doing these exercises.
And as the MSO prepares to perform West Side Story, as the film plays above their heads, concertmaster Frank Allman explains a few of the challenges.
It's this odd thing of having a click track in your ear as well as having a conductor who hopefully is on to the click track and knows the score better than you do.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us today. Earlier this week, the Mount Pleasant Village Board declared an area in the footprint of the proposed Foxconn plant as blighted. The vote was just the latest step in the village's attempt to acquire the land for the construction of the development.
While some residents have already come to an agreement with the municipality, there are still some holdouts. Now it seems the village may try to acquire the rest of the land through eminent domain.
Anthony Sanders is an attorney at the Institute for Justice, which represented homeowners in the case of Kelo versus the City of New London. The eminent domain case reached the U.S. Supreme Court and spurred legislation in states throughout the country.
Sanders joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers and started by explaining Kelo and its impact.
In Kelo versus New London, City of New London, we at the Institute for Justice represented a group of homeowners in the City of New London, Connecticut, including Mrs. Suzette Kelo, who simply wanted to keep their homes. And the city wanted to take their homes and some other properties and use them for private economic development, so give them to another private party. And this was led by the Pfizer Corporation, who wanted to relocate to New London and have a bunch of land for a plant, and then in addition to that, their neighborhood would be used for, it wasn't exactly clear, but luxury condos, hotels, that kind of thing, to service the pharmaceutical plant. We represented them. We fought that taking. We said it was unconstitutional under the Fifth Amendment's public use clause. The case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and in a 5-4 decision, the court ruled that a city constitutionally can take property and give it to another private party just to raise tax revenue. Now, understandably, there was an outrage against this decision. Both parties, left and right, people were outraged by this, that this can't happen in America, people would say. And so to date, 45 states have changed their laws to make it harder for the government to be able to do what happened in Kelo. And Wisconsin was one of those states. In 2006, Wisconsin's changed its law, so it is much harder for cities to take private property and give it to a private corporation such as Foxconn.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the aftermath of that ruling was a lot of states, including Wisconsin, did change their laws. Now, what does the law in the state of Wisconsin say?
Yeah, so there were some reforms to protect property. They didn't go as far as they did in some other states, including Minnesota, where it's very difficult to take property for private economic development. But they were better than they were in other states. So in Wisconsin now, if you have a single-family home that you live in, it is very difficult for a city to take that land and give it to another private party. If you own a business or a farm or some other non-residential property or you're a renter in a property, then the government still, unfortunately, has a lot of power. But for single-family homes, there are very strong protections against economic development and eminent domain abuse.
And what do those protections really look like? Because it seems like that's at the heart of what's happening right now in Mount Pleasant.
Yeah, in Mount Pleasant, what is happening is the village has designated a very large area as a, quote, blighted area. Now, this is ridiculous. There is nothing blighted about the area, and their report trying to justify this blight designation doesn't pass the laugh test. It basically says it's blighted because otherwise we can't turn it into a factory. That's essentially their reasoning. But that wasn't changed in 2006. So cities can still make these blight designations. But just because it's labeled as blighted doesn't mean that the city can then use eminent domain to take all of the land. Blight comes with other goodies for cities. There's certain tax benefits, and they can do some bonding, things like that. But as far as the next step of actually using eminent domain to go in and take people's property, at that point, people who live in single-family homes is very strong protections. People who are businesses and farms and other properties that aren't single-family homes still have some arguments, but the biggest changes from 2006 after Kelo are for these the people in single-family homes, such as those in the Foxconn area.
So how does the blighted designation, how does that help the municipality in this case?
Well, it's a little unclear. Mount Pleasant, just the other day, voted that this large area of beautiful countryside is blighted. And there are certain advantages, as I said, under the law that aren't really relevant here that they get from that designation. But it seems like really the reason they're doing that is so that they can then go to the next step of using eminent domain. Now, a lot of people there are fighting. They think they've been treated very unfairly. So if the city wants to go to the mat and use eminent domain and not pay these people proper replacement costs if they want to get a similar home in the area where land values are now going through the roof because of Foxconn, they are going to have to get around these reforms that the Wisconsin legislature enacted in the wake of Kelo. And it is going to be very difficult for them to do that.
Yeah, how have the homeowners responded to this designation? Are they afraid that the city might now succeed in their hopes of reclaiming this land?
I've spoken to many of the homeowners and some of the attorneys representing them, and they think they have strong legal arguments in response to what the city is doing. And what the city is doing is not only contrary to state law, it's contrary to the Wisconsin Constitution and the U.S. Constitution. Even from what the Kelo case said, as bad as that was, I think Foxconn is actually an even more egregious use of eminent domain than what happened in Kelo. So they may have constitutional arguments that did not succeed in Kelo but would succeed here. So I think they are in very strong position. The downside is it seems like the train has left the station for this huge factory being built in their area, and understandably, a lot of them don't want to live in this beautiful countryside now that it's no longer that. It's going to be next to a huge factory.
Yeah. How does this case compare to the situation in Kelo, but also other eminent domain situations?
Sure. It is very similar. So some of your listeners may know there is a movie that just came out in the last couple months called Little Pink House. For those of your listeners who haven't seen it and maybe have a chance of showing it in the area or when it comes out on video, please take a look. It's a great movie. It was shown last night right outside of Mount Pleasant, and I was present along with a lot of homeowners and other interested people. And in watching this movie and watching what happened to Suzette Kelo and her neighbors and how the case went to the Supreme Court and the actions of the city officials in New London, people were saying, this is just like what's happening to us. And I was struck. I'd seen the movie before, but in sitting there watching it, I had this emotional reaction that, wow, what's going on with Foxconn is just like what happened with Pfizer and the city of New London. And unfortunately, this has happened many other times elsewhere in the country where big government and big business get together to take away the common people's property rights. When this happens, people need to remember they have options available to them. There's places like the Institute for Justice. There's the Constitution. There's state laws that the Wisconsin legislature and other legislatures have enacted to make sure this kind of thing doesn't happen. And I'd encourage people to go use those tools if this comes to their neighborhood.
What are the options for the people in Mount Pleasant moving forward?
Their options will come when the city decides to use eminent domain. So in Wisconsin, you can't, the understanding generally is that you can't go to court and prevent this until the city comes to you. So the city will make some kind of offer that will start the eminent domain process. If a homeowner doesn't want to take that offer, and there's no reason they should because it's their property, they can then go to court to try to challenge the city's use of eminent domain to take their property. And then that will be heard before a state judge. And then after that ruling, the issue could go on appeal, and it could end up before the Wisconsin Supreme Court or even the U.S. Supreme Court one day.
I mean, the Foxconn deal itself has really been, kind of Governor Walker's baby. Has he made any comments about the use of eminent domain in this case? I know some of the gubernatorial candidates have made mention of it.
Sure. I don't know of him or other high-profile Republicans commenting on this use of a potential use of eminent domain now. I do know that the Foxconn legislation that was passed last year did not address eminent domain, so it did not have, say, a carve-out for this project that would allow the village or the state to skirt eminent domain protections. So those protections from 2006 are still in place. And so I would just encourage all politicians in Wisconsin to remember that in 2006, the people were united against preventing something like Kelo, the case that had come out just 1 year prior, and put these protections into place, and that there's no reason that politicians from both sides can't be against this abuse of property rights in 2018.
All right. Well, Anthony, thank you so much for joining me and speaking with me on this topic.
Thank you so much, Joy. It's been a pleasure.
Anthony Sanders is an attorney at the Institute for Justice. He's been meeting with residents in Mount Pleasant who are affected by the Foxconn development. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
We'll take a quick break now, and then Fit for You looks at a boxing gym in West Allis specializing in working with Parkinson's patients. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Parkinson's disease is a degenerative neurological condition that over time causes patients to lose muscle and body control. It can start out as something as simple as a limp, progress to tremors, and can eventually leave a patient entirely incapacitated.
While doctors and hospitals can offer medication, surgery, and physical therapy, some patients are looking for a supportive group environment with others who see Parkinson's as just one part of their lives. And in one group, they're fighting to stave the disease off with a punching bag.
On this month's Fit for You, Audrey Nowakowski takes us to Rocksteady Boxing in West Allis, where a group of boxers all have Parkinson's and are exercising to improve their lives.
Bionic Woman, Rockin' Rabbi, The Enforcer. These are just some of the names of boxers who meet several times a week at a West Allis gym. What makes this group of fighters unique is that not only are they honing their skills, they're also fighting Parkinson's disease. For this month's Fit for You, I joined a group of fighters for a class at Rocksteady Boxing to learn more. Today's class involved pairing up and moving to different stations for 1 minute at a time. The fighters did everything from hula hoops, jump rope, push-ups, burpees, bouncing medicine balls, and driving their knees into a punching bag.
Okay, here we go. 1 minute. Ready, set.
And of course, we can't forget what they love the most, punching things.
All right, first two up, face the bag.
Loud.
Ready, set, and go.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Mama, 1, 2's loud.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
That's what I'm talking about.
That's it.
class participants range in age and physical abilities, but they all come full force in support of one another to fight against Parkinson's. Fast Forward Fitness owner Dale Jack and Cricket Green join me after class to talk about the program that has changed their lives. Jack starts by explaining the connection between boxing and Parkinson's.
A number of years ago of 60 different sports and determined that boxing by degree of difficulty was the top out of 60 sports. So what we do know as far as Parkinson's is concerned is that forced intense exercise, basically just restating that is exercising beyond a volunteer rate, is sort of the sweet spot for helping stop the progression of Parkinson's in a lot of cases. So that if we know that the boxing training is the most intense form, and we know that forced intense exercise is a boon to people with Parkinson's disease, then we know that the marriage of those two are a good fit.
Can you clarify a little bit what it is to go beyond a volunteer rate?
Absolutely. So basically, a volunteer rate is anything that you do where you sort of feel comfortable, you can hold easy conversation, and you can do that in typically about the point where you want to say, okay, enough is enough, I want to stop, I want to quit. That's where we keep going. That's where we go beyond the volunteer rate.
Can you explain what Parkinson's does to the body and how boxing exercises help to slow that progression?
Yes. So Parkinson's is a neurodegenerative disease where certain dopamine-stimulating cells, producing cells in the brain, in a region of the brain, die off. Once those cells die off, the neurons start to fire erratically, making it very hard or sometimes impossible for a person to direct or control their body functions. That can mean slowness of movement. It can mean postural instability, which has to deal with balance and coordination. There can often be tremors, I think, which is most times associated with Parkinson's disease. The lowering of the voice, there's a whole host of symptoms that kind of come along with that.
So, Cricket, when did you first get diagnosed with Parkinson's, and what did you know at the time to even be able to deal with the disease or combat it?
I was in my 30s when I was diagnosed, and that's young for a person. And they thought I started limping with my leg. And I went to many doctors, many medications, and had an MRI done, and they told me I had Parkinson's.
What went through your brain at that first diagnosis?
They give you this book and tell you everything you wanted to know about Parkinson's, but they make you feel you're going to be like a vegetable. So it was really scary finding out.
Did you feel like there was much hope to live a quality life or prolong it before you just got this information about an eventual vegetative state?
No.
So when did you first come to this gym to start boxing?
About 16 months ago.
And what have you found that it's done for you since you started the program?
Balance, and you get to act like a little kid and have fun. And the coaches are awesome and wakes you up.
Before coming to boxing, did you have any other group environments with other people who are also dealing with their Parkinson's disease?
No, I was going to go to support groups, but I didn't want to go because they show the worst people. And wheelchairs and drooling, and I didn't want to be more depressed.
You mentioned here you can be a little kid. You all can have fun together. So how important is it for you from diagnosis to now to keep exercise as an important part of your life? Was it essential before?
Yeah. I used to be in aerobics and used to walk around gyms and stuff, but now I do this every day. My boxing exercises and my physical therapy, and I ride the bike for 30 minutes every day, and I lift weights.
Excellent. Now, Daryl, what were you doing before you discovered this boxing curriculum for PD, and what drew you to it?
So I've owned Fast Forward Fitness for about 10 years now, and I really specialized in weight loss. So I was predominantly doing that, and just by sort of happenstance, I had a sort of mutual friend of a friend who was diagnosed fairly early on with Parkinson's disease, and I was passed a piece through YouTube about this boxing program that was helping people with Parkinson's disease, and I was instantly drawn to that. I had also been doing, I'd been a certified kickboxing instructor. So I'd been using a lot of those principles, so this had really caught my eye. And within 2 weeks, I was down in Indianapolis getting certified to become certified for Rocksteady Boxing.
Now, the class I just observed, it was so much more than just boxing. In fact, they didn't even put on the gloves until the last portion of the class. So what are you incorporating into your classes, and what does it do for the body for people dealing with Parkinson's?
Yeah, so basically what you would typically see in a regular fighter's training regimen, somebody who's training to become a professional fighter, you're going to see a lot of those, many of those aspects in what we do on a day-to-day. So we'll work on core exercises. We'll work on footwork. We'll work on hand-eye coordination, speed of movement, all the things you would see in a regular boxer we're taking on, and it's just happens to be people with Parkinson's that are doing these exercises.
So it's never been teaching a boxing class to people with PD. It's simply teaching a boxing class for you.
Absolutely.
With the group camaraderie and people coming together, just like you, Cricket, what do you find that some of your favorite exercises have been that you've been introduced to at Rocksteady?
The hula hoop.
Hula hoop?
Yeah. And the monkey, barrels of monkeys, and jump rope, and hitting the punching bag, and hitting people lightly, gently.
What does it mean to you to have the group here that you see multiple times a week?
Oh, it's awesome. It makes you feel like you're not alone. You're helping other people because you see all kinds of development from severe to not so much, and you complain about it to a person that knows what you're going through. It's hard to tell a person that they what we're going through, because you can't tell a person what they can't make you feel it. You can't, if you say I can't get my shoes and socks on, you can't understand that, but it's hard to do.
Having that group and that community here, has it made you view your disease any differently?
Yes, you don't feel so all alone. You have company.
And with this program and these people, I imagine that the curriculum is helping you go beyond what you had. So what have you noticed changed in your body? You mentioned earlier you were once in a wheelchair and had the surgery for correction. But, you know, even mentally, emotionally, how have you felt?
Oh, I crack jokes. I'm funny.
And what else do you do outside of boxing here to keep busy, keep active, stay moving?
Here at the food pantry 4 days a week, and I love it.
And with this gym, Daryl, I'll point this one to you. What's your favorite aspect about teaching this group of people with Parkinson's boxing and having this special energy, this special connection with all of your clients?
There's always this bit of apprehension when people come into this, because most people have never done boxing and they've certainly never seen themselves ever doing boxing. So they come in here with a lot of apprehension, which is normal. But the things that they're able to accomplish and sort of watching people sort of blossom and flourish in this environment, and some people have really been fairly sedentary throughout their lives, and at this stage where they come in with Parkinson's, needing to be a fighter, how they can really step up to the plate and develop as a person. And you quickly come to find out that these are not a bunch of just disabled people, that they're people who are showing up and they're boxing. They are fighters and they're fighting Parkinson's, and they do so tenaciously.
Cricket, what would you say to someone if they are dealing with a PD diagnosis and don't yet have any support groups, any programs like this? What would you say to convince them to get in the door?
I would say you're going to have a ball. The coaches are awesome, and it'll make you feel better. Your balance, if you fall down, you learn to get up off the floor if you're by yourself, and everything else goes with it.
And what is your favorite part about coming here?
The coaches, they're awesome. They help you if you need help, but they don't overhelp you because you want to do it yourself.
And I imagine, Daryl, that's very important, and part of the training of certification is that you are pushing everyone here within their comfort level, but not, of course, without safety.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the most important things. And one of the biggest challenges we face as coaches is getting the opportunity to take somebody from a point where they don't feel that they can do something and challenging it to prove to themselves that they can do it. And for some reason, if they're not able to do it, we kind of help facilitate them and get them to the point where they can take that first baby step to try it out and see if they can do it. And I would say 9.9 times out of 10, everybody's been able to rise to the occasion.
How do you reflect when you see Cricket today compared to when she first came in your door?
It's amazing the difference, and I got to say one of the best parts about Cricket is she's got an amazing sense of humor. We love her so much for that. She's so funny. She hasn't lost that, but she has gained quite a bit as far as her physical attributes. Her balance is a lot better. She's much stronger. Just her being able to get in and out of a chair, I've seen quite a big difference in that, which is super important, as you heard her speak on sort of being able to do things on your own and keeping your independence, which is the major goal here.
Cricket, how does it affect your life outside of these doors, having this class?
Well, I can only drive to the food pantry. That's all I drive to. I can't walk that far. I hate to say depressing things. You know, I'd rather say I'd be up person. Like the people at the food pantry, I tell them I'm taking boxing, and they, don't hurt me, don't hurt me. And they have different names for me too. I'm Cricket Wireless at the food pantry. Or Ninja Turtle Princess, they call it. So I have a myriad of names.
Well, and I imagine this class here will help you continue to work at the food pantry, continue to have the independence that you're able to have.
Yes, I like to tell everybody at the food pantry that I love them, and that I'll see them tomorrow, and my boxing friends too, I love them, and I'll see them at boxing.
All right, here we go. We are
For Lake Effect, I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
Daryl Jack and Cricket Crean spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about Rocksteady Boxing, a program that helps people combat the symptoms of Parkinson's disease.
Moving Day Milwaukee is tomorrow at Hart Park at the Chestnut Street Common Picnic Area in Wauwatosa as part of the National Parkinson's Foundation's efforts to combat the disease. You can learn more about the event and listen to past Fit for You segments at WUWM.com.
Flowers are in bloom around southeastern Wisconsin. That includes the flowers in all but one case in Lake Effect SAS Megan Schultz's yard.
How to deal with your kids when they make you really, really angry. For example, like when your two boys use their play swords to hack every single peony bud on the bush you transplanted from your Nana's house. First of all, do not remind yourself that this bush came all the way from Ohio, or that your mom sprinkled her mom's ashes on it 3 years ago, and that ever since, the blooms have quadrupled in number and actually smell like the inside of your Nana's house when she was alive. Do not remind yourself that peonies bloom only once, and that therefore you will not see a single flower this year. Instead of screaming for all the neighborhood to hear, step back inside the house, lock your boys outside, and calmly return to pureeing the soup on the stove. Remind yourself that these are flowers. Special flowers, of course, but flowers nonetheless. No one is dead. Yet. Once you've taken a deep breath and checked to make sure there are no choking hazards on the baby's high chair where she sits staring at you, head back outside. When you see that your boys are laughing maniacally at what they've done, do not recall how earlier in the week you talked to your elder boy, the 6-year-old, about his great-grandmother and why this bush was more treasured than any of the other peonies dotted around the yard. Do not interpret his evil laugh to mean that he is, indeed, a devil child. And do not follow that train of thought with the next obvious thought, that you are raising a devil child. And that since you stay home while your husband works, this is all your fault. Whatever you do, do not lay the blame at your own feet. This is not the time. Instead, walk over to the boys as calmly as you can and take the swords out of their hands. since they're foam, bend them in half, and say in the strange guttural voice that only comes when every bit of breath has been exhaled, "You will never use these swords again." Then find a large knife, cut the swords in half, and throw them in the garbage. Try to forget that every parenting book you've read says that punishments are not the way to deal with events like this, or that they will only serve to make things worse in the long run when you tell them they cannot wear their sweats or their basketball jerseys or the sporty shorts they love to school this week. Forget about the experts as you swipe your elder son's Pokemon cards off the kitchen table and into a bag, along with his Lego Ninjago character encyclopedia and his new baseball hat. Remember, you are nearly 43 years old, and the fact that they will no longer go to the water park this Friday when school is off is not revenge. Try to think of it as a lesson instead. That will help. And if, after your husband rushes home because you told him to hurry back, saying that if he didn't, you might actually beat his child, which, of course, you would never, ever do, but which somehow oddly calms you to say aloud, if you feel like you want to collapse in heaps of sobs for everything, for the flower heads now strewn around the garden, for your mother who is coming to visit in 2 weeks and would have seen them at their peak, which also happens to be the anniversary of her mother's death, for yourself and the way you reacted and what the neighbors must think, for the boys you will have to put to bed tonight and the kisses you still have to give, and for the fury in the pit of your stomach that simply will not budge. Well, that's okay, too. It pretty much always helps to cry in these situations. You can even let your boys see you cry if you'd like. And when your son hands you a note that he wrote on some of the nicest stationery you own, stationery that he dug out from your desk drawer, the kind you save for really important letters, and you can just about make out that it says, "To Mom, I'm sorry for what I did." Try to remember that this is a really important letter, and pull him in and give him a hug. You don't have to tell him that it's okay, but tell him that you still love him, and you always will.
Lake Effect essayist Megan Schultz writes and lives on Milwaukee's East Side.
We'll take one last break, and then MSO concertmaster Frank Allman and his equally talented and musical brother drummer Cliff Allman join us to chat about the MSO's upcoming performance of West Side Story. Lake Effect continues with that in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. And I have always wanted to use that as my introduction music.
Me too. And if you don't immediately recognize it, it's part of the score from the musical West Side Story. And this weekend, the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra will accompany the Academy Award-winning motion picture live on stage at the Marcus Center.
West Side Story's music was written by Leonard Bernstein and is syncopated, lush, and rhythmic. In addition to the regular percussion found in a symphony orchestra, the score requires a set of drums like you'd find in a jazz or rock and roll band.
And that's how the MSO's concertmaster Frank Allman found himself performing this weekend with his younger brother, Cliff, who's an accomplished professional drummer. They both joined me in the studio to talk about what it's like to play such an iconic and complex score to the film.
Well, in this case, it's really odd for us because the only time we ever play this music in orchestra pretty much is with the suite that Bernstein arranged. And we actually did this score once before with the film. It was years ago.
I think it was before I was here because I don't remember it.
It could be. I remember being very disoriented because, first of all, you're playing with a click track because it's all got to be absolutely synchronized. And secondly, that the tempi in the film were really different than what we were used to playing in the suite. So the suite is usually done as part of a concert program, obviously, and you can kind of do what you want with it, depending on who's conducting. And with the film, you're just locked in. You're strapped in and you're stuck with what's up there. So the tempi were sometimes much faster and less often slower than we were used to. There was also just the idea of playing along exactly with a click which I think is more common with drummers or other kinds of music. But yeah, that was the biggest thing, that the tempi were different and we had no wiggle room at all. But it was,
And it's longer because the symphonic dances are about 20 minutes.
Right, and this is something like 3 hours. So there's a slight difference.
Well, you're on the click track, yeah.
No, I mean, I don't think it's that long, but it's a substantial score. I think the first violin part's something like 88 pages or something. It's a real thing.
And Bernstein is not known for being an easy composer.
No, it's a really challenging score, I think, for everybody by design. You know, he was a fantastic composer and always wanted to be known almost exclusively as a composer, I think, was his big dream. And, wound up being known for practically everything. Great conductor, sort of Renaissance guy. But I don't think anybody could argue that this is really one of the masterpieces of the 20th century, especially when you fold in, it's almost impossible for us to imagine a project that involved Leonard Bernstein, Jerome Robbins, Shakespeare to a certain extent, and a very, very young Stephen Sondheim,
Well, it changed American musical theater.
Yeah, totally.
Completely. Yeah, yeah. It was one of those things, those confluence of people and events. And so, Cliff, for you, have you done this before? Have you performed this score at all?
I have not. This is my first time playing it. I've been in situations performing with orchestras before, but not along with a film that was, I've played on film scores with an orchestra there playing with the film, but playing a score, recreating a score that was cut with the film from this period, which I believe was what, 1960?
Yeah, the film's from 1961. So the technology was really different. The click, it's not just having, it's not just having a click, it's that the click goes back and forth a little bit just because of the technology at the time.
Yeah, they weren't using metronomes for recording, I don't believe, at that time. From what I understand, they used to use for hit tunes, they would use a stopwatch and actually time it and make sure that they would do the math somehow. But when they recorded this film, I'm assuming they just were on a sound stage playing along with it and, tracking to what they were seeing. When you recreate it, because it wasn't locked to a metronome or a guide of some sort, which essentially creates a grid mathematically for people to follow, so the time is even or the time is this and that. In this case, it's a broader spectrum where there are a lot of pushes and pulls because nothing was recorded that way originally. So when you play along with it, you have to chase the click. The click is not there as a metronomic guide as much as it is for guiding you in and out of what the original orchestra did, right? So there are things that don't necessarily make sense mathematically, like I'm speaking as a drummer now, because we tend to think in terms of a grid and like a very sort of fixed time concept. It just goes all over the place.
So in a way, it adds another layer of complexity to what you're already doing.
Yeah, it does. And also there's a, because you're playing along with the actor's parts on stage or in the film. And it is like, I've done some Broadway stuff and it's kind of similar to that. Except, it's much more fixed to what's going on because this is all recorded. There's no flexibility in what you're playing with.
The other thing is that I found out later there were a lot of overdubs to the score.
Yeah, if you listen to the actual score, because I actually downloaded the score and listened to it straight from the film, not the recording, because I wanted to hear all the little things in between and the fades and all that. And you can tell there are some pretty big cuts. You can hear significant differences in the way, where the drums are panned or where something is, off, in a split second. Like, 1 minute, the drums will be over here, and then there will be a cut, and the next minute they're on the other side. So you can tell that someone did a significant edit in there somewhere.
And one other thing, another layer of complexity for us as musicians is that there's this conductor.
Oh, him.
So it's this odd thing of having a click track in your ear as well as having a conductor who hopefully is on to the click track and knows the score better than you do. I'm confident that's the case here, although we haven't rehearsed it yet. But Bill Edens is fantastic, and I'm sure it'll be great. But, if that gets off a little bit, then you make your choice.
Yeah, then you have a possible bloodbath.
Yeah, or yeah. just go with the drummer. That's
yeah. Well, now see, now then in that case, speaking of that, then the drummer ends up having to kind of be the bad guy because
right.
eventually you're going to have to get back to the click, and there are a lot of debatable concepts of that. But if you're playing with a pre-fixed piece of music that a click has been mapped around, ultimately, I mean, I don't want to say that's the I guess it is. It's the final, because I don't have a choice. The drummer, who is essentially the skeleton of depending on what style the piece we're playing is in, especially if it's something that's drum driven.
Which this is in a lot of ways.
Aside from the rubato areas, of, you know, different areas where it's looser, but if you get off with the click, you're going to have to catch back up to it or you're going to be completely off with the film.
Generally, the drummers are the bad guy anyway.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
Volume-wise, click-wise, we're just not very looked on, you know.
No. So why the drums for you? I understand, you know, you had more of the classical training like Frank when you guys were growing up.
No, I don't know if that's necessarily the case. I mean, our parents are classical people and they did their best to put me down that road, but I just
steer
them
away
really,
from it.
Yeah, I just never really felt it the same way, and I didn't really gravitate toward it the way I did toward drums, and I don't think that they expected that either.
But we also, I mean, they were younger too, and we were exposed to a lot of different kinds of music. I mean, they both were in the classical world to a certain extent, but we had a lot of stuff around the house growing up.
There's a lot of Beatles. You know, a lot of Beatles.
I was going to say, Beatles, I hope yeah. you didn't take your drumming from that.
I did, actually.
Did you really?
A lot of it. I have a lot of respect for them. And I didn't when I was going through my more snooty jazz phases. But now that I've kind of come back around, it's a whole different perception.
Pete Best is his hero. Huh. Oh, you mean the other drummer.
The other drummer.
The other guy.
Ringo.
The other guy.
Yeah, Ringo's the guy.
Yeah. I can't remember his last name.
Yeah. See, he's not very famous, so it doesn't really matter anyway. Nobody will know.
Right.
So growing up and really getting into the drums, who were you listening to besides the Beatles?
When I started out, actually, I should mention, too, that Frank had a garage band that he played drums in.
Did you really?
He doesn't tell anybody about that.
Probably poorly. But at least I had some exposure to it, and I think it was, especially when we wound up in, we were roommates in New York for a while. I was, I think, just out of school and you were getting going. But I think the way classical musicians think about time is really, really different than a drummer, basically. Drummers tend to think of time more in terms of the way that we think of something like intonation, or there's always dynamics. But the shadings of rhythm and time that go into jazz especially, or other kinds of music that drummers have to be a little more aware of, it's not just 2 and 4 like a Beethoven or Brahms symphony, or it gets sometimes a little more complex if, you know, you're talking about Stravinsky. But that's a difficult concept to get across to a lot of classical musicians. You know, you talk about being on the front end of the beat, you know, somebody
or behind
you,
it,
or a little bit behind, you know. Yeah. And they're like, what are you talking about? You know, it's either you're either ahead or you're behind. And it's not really the case. You know, you can create certain effects in classical music by slight pushes of momentum. And some performers are really known, or some soloists especially, are really known for that. Or the opposite, you know, being on the back end of the beat. Bernstein, for example, you know, these amazing recordings of the Brahms symphonies towards the end of his life with the Vienna Philharmonic, where all of a sudden there was this great sort of slowdown and expansiveness to those recordings when you compare them to what he was doing early in his career. They're amazing to listen to in a certain way and certainly to compare. But for whatever reason, that's how he, you know, that's where he ended up with those pieces.
Do you think he was thinking more like a drummer would think in terms of time at that point?
I don't know. I think part of it was him just sort of wallowing in that sound and maybe the way he had rethought the way that he would interpret those pieces, because he wasn't doing it with everything. It was just, it seemed to be that and Mahler, you know.
Just really opening it up and
kind of lingering to a fault to some people, depending on your point of view.
Yeah, people can say that's self-indulgent, you know, to you know, you're not serving the music. But I don't know. I mean, you either like it or you don't, I guess.
Yeah, I love those recordings.
Yeah. They're really rich. And to me, it's Bernstein being Bernstein, you know, in that big, lush, romantic heart of his, which I always think was at the core of everything he did.
Yeah, he was certainly, you know, an amazing guy on so many levels, and he didn't do anything halfway, that's for sure.
Yep. Nope, he did not. He lived a very big life, you know, which is terrific.
How old was he when he passed away?
80-something?
Yeah, something like that. It was 1982, right?
Yeah, I think so.
82, 83.
It was the early 80s, Google that. And, and I mean, when you think of what he went through in terms of how classical music changed and you know, how jazz changed during that time, too. He was listening to all of that as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, that was one of the things I always liked about him, is that he wasn't exclusively one genre of music. He was paying attention to what was going on in pop music and what was going on in jazz, what was going on in everything.
Politically?
Yep.
He gave, you know, that's what I mean by just sort of this Renaissance guy. It's hard to imagine it. A conductor or a music director right now who did anything close to what he did in terms of the scope of artistic activities and even cultural activities, you know.
So, Cliff, when you've been listening to this, and I realize you haven't gotten into rehearsal yet, but what do you think of the score?
Well, I mean, it's everything you guys are discussing. It's you know, I should say I was not completely familiar with the ins and outs of it. I did see it when you guys did it before.
We realized that after we were talking about Cliff coming to play. You happened to be visiting or something,
right? Yeah, I was
right?
visiting, and I just went to the performance, and I sat with Frank's kids and watched it, and it was the first time I saw the film. And I don't really remember walking away. I remember walking away from that thinking, like, that's really complicated. Like what they would have to do, and then him and I had spoken about it, and he said that, you know, we had to chase the click a lot and this and that. And then I started listening to it. I listened to over the last month or two, I've been listening to the original recording.
Month or two? Really? Wow.
Yeah, I mean, once they told me it was gonna happen, I started checking it out because
I should probably pick up my part then.
Frank's never heard it before.
What time is the rehearsal?
Yeah. Do you even know how to play the violin? I'm just checking.
That depends on who you talk to.
Yeah, that's debatable. But, you know, so I started checking, and then I got the score, maybe a month ago, a few weeks ago, and I was looking at it, and I noticed, the first thing you noticed, if you've done any film recording or anything, when they release a soundtrack, that's, of course, not everything that was in the film, just the hits are in the film, basically. So there's all these little, you know, play-ons and play-offs and things like that, and there's a lot of time signature stuff in this score. There's a lot of 6/8 things that I couldn't find where one was without a click. I couldn't hear the phrase listening to it because I didn't have a conductor telling me where it was. I was following a score, and then I would hear a hit or a passage, and then I'd hear where the time was and go back and try to, you know, get inside of it and see. Because for me, stuff like this, I try to train my ear as much as I can before I get into it so I don't have to worry about the score. Because essentially, if you're playing drums with an orchestra, eventually you're going to be looked to sort of lay the law down, especially in a click situation. Of course, the conductor has the final say in that, but you're trying to work with him. And if you're worried about reading every last little thing for the first time, there's three things there you have to worry about. So I try to alleviate one of those by learning as much as I can about it. And that's what I did. And the more I got inside of it, I mean, there's a lot of things that were going on at that time, like you were talking about. There are references to Latin music, mambo music, and there's some swing sections. There's
straight Broadway sections. I mean, there's stuff that's just like...
There's all kinds of stuff. There's a lot of what we call boom chick. You know? And that moves around, you know, with the clicks. You know? Because you're following a vocal that wasn't cut to a click. So now, if you did something like this now, or they recorded it now, everything
just do it on
would,
a laptop.
Right. You just put it in Logic and fix all of it.
Yeah. Everything would be tidied up.
Yeah. Sure.
Yes. Yeah. Well, in some ways, I think it's kind of fun that maybe less so for you, but it's fun for us to kind of, you know, see how you negotiate that, because it feels more like, even though, yes, you're playing to the film, you're doing it kind of in real time. and you're...
And it's live.
It's live.
I mean, it's just not canned.
That's what I mean by real time. Yeah, it's happening right now, and we feel that.
Yeah, I think this is a great example of the difference between listening to a recording and hearing a live performance is the ultimate example, really, when you see something like this with a film.
Have you guys done other films in this?
Oh, yeah. This is a great series, yeah.
We've done Harry Potter movies.
Was
Star
that
Wars
clicked?
Movies. Some of it was, yeah. Yeah. Mm. What else have we done? Raiders.
Yep.
We did Raiders.
Wow.
Yeah.
But those were all cut.
They were.
They were
more
all
recently.
Cut with a clip. Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
We
did Godfather.
Oh, really?
I don't think had a click.
70s?
It did for part of
it.
Yeah,
might have.
Yeah.
I mean, they could always add a click to it later, but that doesn't mean that, you know, you're just using that as a different guide, but it's something.
Well, I know we're all really looking forward to it. It is one of my favorite scores of Broadway, but just of music in general. It's not just a Broadway score, as we've been saying. But Frank and Cliff, I want to thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Frank Almond is the concertmaster for the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. His brother, Cliff Almond, is a professional drummer.
The Almond brothers, and yes, sorry, I couldn't resist, along with the rest of the MSO, will accompany the Academy Award-winning motion picture West Side Story live on stage at the Marcus Center Saturday evening and Sunday afternoon. You can find more information about tickets and times at WUWM.com. And West Side Story sends us into the weekend on Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Bonnie and I produce the show along with Joy Powers, Audrey Nowakowski, and production assistant Maddie Andre. This week, we welcome our four newest staffers, interns Ben Benversi, Lauren Keene, Gabby Powell, and Robin DiGiacinto to the Lake Effect family for the summer.
We also get additional reporting from Susan Bentz. We get web support from managing editor Michelle Maternowski and studio engineering from Jason Reavy. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.